It'll be a busy week for the tax reform bill. The House Republican plan released last week is being poked and prodded by lawmakers, lobbyists, think tanks, and experts. What income groups will see the greatest tax cuts? Let's let Kevin McKinley get under the hood of the bill for this edition of On Your Money. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Kevin, welcome back. Kevin, are you there?
Hello, Kate.
Well, Kevin, there may be some changes to the federal tax code coming in the next few months. What do you have to say about that?
Well, we've got a little bit to say about it. Normally, Kate, we don't really like to spend a lot of time talking about pending legislation because it's a Republican-sponsored bill and Republicans are generally in power federally. But there are a lot of different kinds of Republicans out there and not all of them agree on every single change that needs to be made to the tax code. So it's unlikely to pass as it is, and it's unlikely to pass in some cases even at all. But it's so close to the year end that the changes that are made could take place effective January 1st, which is only about 6 weeks away. So it's worth talking about now.
Who would be helped if this bill were passed as is?
Well, a lot of us could be. According to the New York Times, the tax cuts would help 68% of families who make between $50,000 and $150,000 per year. But generally, of course, anytime you're talking about tax cuts, the lion's share of the dollar amount of cuts already go to people who are paying a lot of income taxes. That would be corporations, the pass-through corporations, which are times when profits go directly to the owners and are taxes at ordinary income. That top rate would drop from 39.6% down to 25%. And C corporations, these are usually larger businesses, that top rate drops from 25% down to 20%, or 35% down to 20%, rather. Investors would get a break. Heirs of huge estates would get a break. The estate tax exemption would go from $5 million plus up to $10 million. The alternative minimum tax would be eliminated. That's a way that was created in the 60s to tax people who, through use of deductions, made a lot of money but didn't pay any taxes at all because they had other losses that they carried forward or other expenditures. And they had basically, we all have two different ways we have to figure our taxes. One, the regular route, and the other, your alternative minimum tax. And then whichever is the highest dollar amount federally, that's what we have to pay. Well, that alternative minimum tax would be eliminated. But the biggest change to this and those the way it would affect the average population is they would basically double the standard deduction up to $12,200 for single filers and $24,400 for married couples filing jointly. So that amount would be pulled off of your taxable income right away before any of these other bracket rates would hit.
So who may end up paying more in taxes?
Those same people who got the tax break, the 68% the New York Times says will get a break now, might end up paying more later on because several of these exemptions would expire. Some families with children might pay more. They lose an exemption, but they do gain a higher child credit for it. High state tax residents would probably get hurt because they don't get a deduction anymore for state and local income taxes, or that might be capped. Owners of expensive homes under the provisions after November 2nd, people who bought homes worth $500,000 or more would not be able to deduct the interest on the mortgage over and above $500,000. And this would also wipe out the tax break for interest paid on home equity lines of credit and home equity borrowers. And then there were a bunch of other really small ones in there, which were kind of odd. We heard a lot about 401k contributions either being limited or they would be wiped out completely as being tax deductible. That's not going to be the case. But student loan interest would not be tax deductible. Medical expenses would not be able to be itemized. Alimony payments, which right now are tax deductible to the person paying the payments, but taxable to the person receiving them, that would be wiped out. Stadium bonds would not get the tax-free exemption on their interest issued as well. And then this might also affect a lot of people too. You know, under today's laws, Kate, if you live in your primary home 2 out of the last 5 years before you sell it and you have capital gains on it, basically the gains are tax-free. $250,000 for a single filer and $500,000 for married couples filing jointly. This provision would change that, that you had to live in there 5 out of the last 8 years. So people who've moved a little bit and said, we just moved a few years ago, now we're selling the house, we made some money on it, they might be more liable to pay capital gains taxes if they made money on it. And then there were lots of other little ones, too, which, again, were kind of odd. Teachers would lose the $250 exemption. Right now, teachers who buy supplies for their own classroom can deduct up to $250 of the expenses each year. The adoption credit would be lost. Tax preparation fees are tax deductible now. They would not be under this term. And then there's another additional reduction for seniors who are over age 65. That would go away as well. But again, a lot of this would be, these little itemized deductions would be wiped out for many people, the loss of, would be, of which wouldn't be as bad because the standard deduction would be doubling and taking care of a lot of the itemized deductions.
A lot of ifs here, but what will the effect of this legislation be?
Again, we're not really sure if it will go through and in what form. Generally, the thought is that there's going to be more money going to corporations that are going to repatriate money back that they've held overseas because they didn't want it to be taxed. They're going to bring it into back into the states, pay a lower rate on the taxes on it. Some people will claim that's going to go for more jobs. It usually doesn't. It's not expected to. And especially because when people talk about using tax cuts to they're going to instead create jobs. You know, when you pay someone a salary, that money is tax deductible to the business. And so just saying giving them more tax cuts means they're going to create more jobs usually isn't going to be the case. Some of the other small changes could cost some families a few $100 a year. Others will save about the same dollar amount. But many of these little itemized deductions, even if you would be affected by it, you know, people are going to borrow money to buy a house. People are going to borrow money to go to school if they need it. They don't think about the tax deduction as the primary reason to do it. And quite frankly, they shouldn't do that because that's not a big enough reason to take out a loan to go to school or to buy a house. Or for teachers, the teachers I know are still going to buy items for their classrooms, whether or not they get the tax break or not.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making an investment decision. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You can ask your money-related questions for Kevin. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to Harry in Genesee. Hi, Harry.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I have a question. I've got a 529 account for my grandson who'll be starting college next fall. I believe the custodian. My grandson is the beneficiary. Would I be better off transferring the custodian from myself to my daughter from a tax standpoint for the grandson? As I understand it, any benefit from the 529, my grandson would have to list that as income when applying for school aid.
That can happen. The good and the bad news about this is that the way the look-back period works on federal financial aid form, the FAFSA, the action probably won't save him any money this year. It might save some money for him in future years because the look-back period is already going to capture anything you do for it this year. Harry, you said he's going to school next year? Okay. And keep in mind that you don't necessarily, you know, do they have other resources to pay for college, or is this really going to be the lion's share of what they use?
This will be the lion's share.
Okay. You know, it might hurt him on financial aid. Most need-based aid that is awarded is going to be awarded in the form of loans, not in the form of, you know, of grants and scholarships that don't need to be paid back. So even if it does affect his financial aid somewhat, and I don't think it'll be a dramatic effect, it's not like it's going to wipe out a bunch that he otherwise would have received and never have to be paid. But there's a website, Harry, the FAFSA website, which is fafsa.ed.gov. That's the government's website for financial aid. They have something called the Financial Aid Forecaster on there. And you can use that, or your children can use that, to go ahead and calculate what these different moves would mean if you were to pull the money out of the 529 and what it would do to what's known as the expected family contribution. That's the EFC, and that's what is determined that your grandson's parents will have to pay, come up with themselves before any need-based aid is awarded. And we'll put a website, a link to that website up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Harry, thanks for the call. Kevin, a listener named Mitch writes, would my Social Security benefit be greater without 401k contributions, or if those contributions would have been made to a Roth IRA? What about total financial benefit, late career contributions to the 401k versus the Roth?
Let's start with the first question. Contributions to 401ks, 403bs, and IRAs, they reduce income taxation now, but the money that you put in there is still subject to the Social Security tax. So it cuts your IRS bills now, not your Social Security tax costs, but your wages that you earn. The good news about that is the wages that you have coming in are actually boosted up in retirement, or boost the Social Security payments up in retirement.
So how about the second question? Is it better later in your career to contribute to a 401k or a Roth version?
It depends on your current tax bracket versus what the bracket will be when you pull that money back out in retirement. And just to use a simple version of the scenario that most people face is, let's say you had $10,000 that you could contribute either to a 401k or a Roth 401k right now. And let's say you're in the 25% tax bracket this year, but you're retiring on January 1st of 2018, after which you'll be in the 15% federal income tax bracket. If you deposit that $10,000 now into a pre-tax retirement plan, you'll save yourself $2,500 in taxes. And then if you pull it out on January 2nd of 2018, 6 weeks or so away from now, you'll pay $1,500 on taxes on it. So that's $1,000 savings in taxes for something that you have virtually no risk. You just put it into your 401k, you take it back out, and you save $1,000 in taxes in just 7 weeks. Annualized out, that's a 74% annualized rate of return. So again, it's not that dramatic when you're looking over the very long term, but if you're in a higher tax bracket now or a lower tax bracket later, you're better off putting the money into the pre-tax plan now and then paying taxes on it down the road.
Thank you, Mitch, for that question. You're with us on another edition of On Your Money here on the Ideas Network. December 31st only comes around once a year, and there are a number of important financial deadlines to meet before we get to January 1st. Now is the time to start working on an end-of-year financial checklist, and we're exploring the list with Kevin McKinley, a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. You can join in with your question, 800-642-1234. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin, give us a call or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll be back after this on the Ideas Network. IRS recently announced updated retirement plan contribution limits for 2018, and there are some changes taking place. There are new contribution limits that will affect 401k plans, IRA investors, and people who use other types of retirement savings plans. We're getting up to speed on this edition of On Your Money on the morning show. Kevin McKinley is here to break it down. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. There's an open line for you at 800-642-1234. You can join in with your personal finance question or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kevin, we had a listener who couldn't stay with us from Nisita who is wondering, should they focus on paying down their mortgage, or should they make upgrades to their home along the way, or put that money in paying down the mortgage?
I'd rather have them actually make the upgrades, because the upgrades, you know, it's not a question of if they're going to be made, it's when. And, you know, it does add value to the house. Most upgrades one would do to a house will probably contribute about 30 to 60% of the investment. So if you redo your kitchen, you spend $15,000 on it, you're probably going to increase the value of the home, maybe $7,000 or $8,000. And the good news about the difference between that, what you spend and what you get back in increased value, is there's some intangible benefit to enjoying a new kitchen, and one that's well done that you can really appreciate.
Let's savor that comment there just a moment here. Enjoying that kitchen. Okay, now you can move on. I just had to savor it.
It sounds good. You just had coffee this morning at 1 a.m. and you thought, oh, I could use a new kitchen. The part about it that's troublesome is if you're having a difficulty paying for other things, and then you go out and borrow more against your established home equity, of course, that creates problems, because now you have not only your mortgage payment and your other expenses, but you have a home equity loan or line of credit payment to make on that as well. And usually, the banks have a fairly good judge of whether or not you can afford this. Now, they're in the business to lend you money. That's the only way they get paid. So they're going to be a little bit more aggressive on allowing you to borrow money that maybe you can't afford. So figure out the payment for it. But no, I'd much rather have people do what they need to do to the house now and get a home equity line of credit, get a home equity loan, if you want a fixed cost. But either one of those is an acceptable way to finance it. Obviously, paying cash for any renovations are better than borrowing the money for it. But with interest costs so low, lending standards relatively easy, I think it's fine to go ahead and do that again, assuming you can get a low interest loan from the bank.
Let's take a call now at 800-642-1234. Diane is with us from Appleton. Hi, Diane.
Hi, good morning. Kevin, I had a question. My husband and I just went through the FAFSA form, and you know, it was determined that we had made too much money for any support for our daughter going to college. However, my husband and my income changes dramatically from year to year. Up and down it goes. My question is this. Should we or could we be filling out the FAFSA form again next year, in her second year of, before her second year of college, to determine if she might be eligible for any financial aid?
Absolutely, Diane. Not only should you, you really must do it, because to get any financial aid, it's on a year-to-year basis. Just because they say you'll get a lot of aid in the first year doesn't mean you'll get any aid in the second year, especially if you've made more money, and vice versa, if you've had a tougher year and haven't made as much money. Not only that, but even after you fill out the FAFSA and get what's known as the award letter that states whatever type of financial aid the kid might receive, you can call the school back up and say, hey, you don't understand. The information that you're working off of is from 2 years ago, and we've gone through some harder times. We're not making as much money. With that in mind, is there a way that there is other aid for which we might qualify? But to answer your question, Diane, definitely you should fill the FAFSA out every single year. It's kind of like doing your taxes. It's not fun. It's a little easier than it used to be.
It's
not fun.
Kevin, is there any leverage in negotiating with the college, with the school? Does Diane have any leverage there?
Probably not. And for most people who go to state schools, there's usually not a lot of leverage, especially for good students, but not exceptional students. I mean, not students who, you know, have 4.0 and 1600 on their SAT and 36 on their ACT. Those kids have leverage. Sometimes at private schools, the aid package will differ from one to the other, but you might still end up with a higher net cost versus a state school that doesn't give you any financial aid at all. What I would say, Diane, is I would like you to take out, I would assume that your daughter probably received some form of subsidized or unsubsidized federal loan opportunity. Is that correct?
No.
Okay, they didn't even say unsubsidized loans?
Well, maybe there was one line at the very bottom that was something like $3,000 loan or something like that.
Right. And that's
okay,
and that's usually a federal loan, and I would take that because there are The interest is subsidized. There's no credit check to that particular loan. And the interest under today's laws anyway is tax deductible. That would go away if this legislation goes through. But it's still a very low interest rate, and they're income-based repayment plans. So if your child borrows money under the federal loans, whether it's subsidized or unsubsidized, and then doesn't make enough money once leaving school, the payments can be reduced and still stay current. And eventually, if you stay current on that plan, then under the income-based repayment plan, whatever's left over after a long period of time can be forgiven. And so if you are a little concerned about money, not just today for college, but even 5 or 6 years from now, especially if the kids are going on to higher education, like getting a master's degree or whatever, I would take those federal loans. And just it'll cost you a little bit in interest, but it's worth it to get the flexibility so that if interest rates aren't as available in 3 or 4 years, or you really need to borrow, there are limits on what you can borrow under those programs each year. So you're better off taking what you can get every single year. And then if you have a ton of money, once the kid graduates, go ahead and pay those things off. But otherwise, you'll be very glad you can just make those relatively small payments every single month.
Diane, thanks. Good luck. Let's now go to Chris, who has a question in Spooner. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Morning.
Morning.
I enjoy your show so much.
Thank you, Chris.
I have a question. I was listening to you a couple of weeks ago, and you mentioned that we people in retirement should have like an emergency fund of cash or something that we can easily cash in. And I think most of our investments are in mutual funds, and I thought I need to get some of that money out of stocks and bonds and put it into a cash account, right?
If you're looking to, if you don't have a significant amount of savings that's not subject to the ups and downs of the market, Chris, yeah, I would say that would be a good idea and a good time to do
it. Yeah, and I think with the market so high, making me a little bit nervous. But my question is there a way to minimize, reduce, never get rid of the tax implications of cashing in mutual funds that have probably had pretty significant gains over the last 10 years or so?
Sure. Chris, these mutual funds you're talking about, they are held outside of a retirement account, right? They're not in a Roth IRA or an IRA or anything like that, correct?
A bit of it's in IRA.
Okay.
And most of it is just in stocks.
Okay. Well, if you are concerned about the taxes and you want to just minimize your exposure to the stock market, obviously you can sell what's in the IRA with no tax implications whatsoever. So anything in there you can sell, and you can convert that to a money market account. Usually any brokerage account, 401k account, anything like that you have, they have a money market option. If they don't, I'd suggest you open up an IRA at a local bank or credit union and transfer the money to that. You'll still get 1% or 2% on it. It'll be FDIC insured, and it won't be, like I said, subject to any downtrend in the stock market crash, correction, whatever you want to call it. The other ones, you know, you mentioned there's no way to get around the taxes on gains on that, and actually there is. When you incur long-term capital gains and you are in the 15% federal tax bracket, and that usually shakes out at about $50,000 of income for single filers and about twice that, $100,000 for married couples filing jointly. If your income is lower than those figures and you then realize some capital gains, again, staying still below those dollar amounts, the tax rate on those long-term capital gains is 0%. And I'm guessing the funds you're referring to, Chris, or stocks maybe, you've had dividends reinvested over many years, haven't you?
Yes.
Okay. Since you have, you've been paying taxes on those dividends every time they were presented to you each year, if you will. You still paid taxes on that, but then chose to reinvest them, which is a good idea. But it also means that you've raised the overall cost basis of the investment position. So I think if you actually went in and calculated what your potential capital gains tax your capital gains will be, they're probably smaller than you might imagine. And whatever you can sell and remain under the 15% federal income tax bracket is going to be taxed at 0%. And finally, even if it's going to be taxed, the most it's going to be taxed is probably about 15% at the federal level. You've probably made that amount on those stocks just over the last year and a half, which means that you can return back to the dollar amount that you had back then and be tax-free on it. You can even sell the positions today, pay the taxes on it, and you can rebuy them, establishing a new higher cost basis. So yeah, I definitely go through the numbers yourself, Chris, but you'd be very surprised, I think, that how low your tax bill might be.
Chris, good luck. Thanks so much for the call. Do you have a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley? Join in. There's a line for you, 800-642-1234. You can send your question via email to ideas@WPR.org, post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We are less than 8 weeks away from the end of the year. Sounds like a good time, Kevin, to think about what we should do before December 31st.
Yeah, some of the things, Kate, that we can do to cut our taxes can be done by April 15th of next year. But your best chances to save money are doing these things by December 31st of 2017. We'll give you a summary today, and then we'll go into each one of these over more detail over the next few weeks.
All right, so what's first on the list?
You had alluded to this earlier, but the retirement plan contribution limits are going up a little bit after the first of the year, but they're still pretty high right now. It's $18,000 for 401ks for taxpayers who are under age 50, $24,000 per year or your earnings, whichever is less, for those people over age 50. And people should be begging, borrowing, and stealing the money that they need to at least get their employer match. About a third of people who are eligible at large companies to get an employer matching contribution to their retirement plan don't contribute enough to do that. And people, that is free money. So not only do you cut your taxes by making those contributions, save some money for your retirement, but you also get extra money from your boss. It's the easiest way to get a raise. And even the money, if you don't get a match or you're getting all the match you can, any extra dollars you put into your 401k, your 403b, your 457, that right now will cut your taxes that you pay on April 15th by up to 10 to 40%. So $1,000 in today could save you anywhere from $100 to $400 in taxes, and it's still your money. You haven't donated it, you haven't spent it, and you haven't given it away.
And next up,
convert your IRAs to Roth IRAs, especially if you are going to be in a lower tax bracket now rather than what you will be later. And a lot of people who are retired find themselves in a very low income tax bracket and with money that they don't need, but all of a sudden, because they haven't done this conversion, they get to 70.5 and they have to take the required minimum distributions. And the required minimum distributions can actually boost them into a higher income tax bracket. And that 15% federal income tax bracket, Kate, is the line that I really like to think about as the cutoff for it. If you can do any conversions and stay under that bracket, it's a good idea. If you're going over that limit, it's probably not a good idea. And that bracket determination is made by what's on line 43 of your 1040. And we'll put a link up to H&R Block has a nice tax estimator. It's free. You don't have to enter any of your name or identifiable information. But you can play around with it and see what a conversion from an IRA to a Roth IRA would do to your tax bill.
And what about charitable giving?
Yeah, this year might be better than next year. And the reason being is that with that high standard deduction that may come about as part of this pending legislation, charitable giving may not be as attractive to people because you may not be able to deduct it next year, or you might not give enough to have enough itemized deduction for it. So if you have any appreciated assets, or you have stocks or mutual funds that have been held outside retirement accounts where you don't know what the cost basis is, you may want to look at donating that directly to a charity and getting the tax deduction, or putting a larger amount into a donor-advised fund. And the donor-advised fund, again, is kind of your miniature foundation. You can put the money in now, get the big tax deduction, but then give it out as you see fit over subsequent years. And you really don't have to give any dollar amount out to any specific charity. You can just let it stay in there. There's other different investment options, kind of like a 401k that we might have at work. And then finally, the provision that allows people who don't itemize to still deduct their required minimum distribution from their IRA is still in place, and it's been made permanent. But of course, as we see with all tax laws, permanent should be in quotation marks because we don't know what is permanent and what is not. But this year, anyway, you can still move your IRA required minimum distribution, if you're over 70.5, to a charity, and it's not taxable to you.
So speaking of required minimum distributions, those also have a year-end deadline, don't they?
Yes, they do. And it's not just for IRAs, but also for 401ks and 403bs and 457s if you're over 70 and a half and not working anymore. And we're seeing this a lot more recently because the first generation of people who established retirement accounts for themselves in the 80s is passing away. And so many people have inherited IRAs or Roth IRAs. They also have to take a required minimum distribution by December 31st. And it's very important that you take that distribution in the proper amount, because if you don't take enough out, the IRS will tax whatever you should have taken out but did not at 50%, meaning if you were supposed to take $10,000 out of a retirement account under the RMD laws and you don't, the IRS will still make you take it out once they catch it, and then they'll tax you $5,000 on that $10,000 distribution. And it is your responsibility as an IRA owner to do it, but you can still contact your tax or your financial advisor to see if they can help you do it, or contact the current custodian, meaning if you have an IRA at a bank or credit union or a brokerage firm or Schwab or Fidelity or Vanguard, contact them and say, is there anything you can do to help me figure out what I need to take out of this to meet the requirements?
And are there any other financial housekeeping moves that need to be made by December 31st?
Checking off your list right now, Kate, all the things that you need to do.
Yeah.
Specifically for tax cutting and planning, and again, with this pending legislation, you may want to bunch your deductions for 2017. And for a lot of people, that means prepaying the property taxes that are due in 2018 before December 31st of this year so that they're big enough to offset the standard deduction. You would also want to sell any losers of investments that you have, so that can offset income and capital gains taxes. And then again, like Chris brought up, selling anything that can be taxed at 0%, and if you love the investment, you might want to sell it now, pay 0% capital gains taxes on it, and then rebuy that position. You still own it, but then you've got a higher cost basis on it, and that'll give you more freedom in the future.
Let's take another call now. Mark in La Crosse. Hi, Mark.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking the call. Many years ago, I transferred a 401 into a variable annuity, and that's been kind of not very productive for me. And I was wondering about good ways to maybe move some of that money elsewhere.
Yeah, Mark, I'm sorry to hear that. You're certainly not alone in the sentiment about the advantages of variable annuities. Usually they have some features and benefits, but often the internal costs and expenses of those the types of investments are so high that they eat into a lot of the return that you might otherwise have received. So, Mark, this is probably an IRA for you now, right?
It is. Yep.
Okay.
It's considered a traditional IRA.
Okay. And how many years ago did you move the money into the variable annuity?
It was in 1999.
Okay. Good news. That was, 18 years ago. You have you've probably gone past any surrender charges for that variable annuity, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so you can move that money out of that variable annuity, probably all of it, and not suffer any surrender charges. What you might lose, though, especially for an annuity that's that old, is there could be an enhanced death benefit, or there could be a guaranteed minimum income benefit on there that exceeds the value of the account. Do you know, Mark, if any of those things hold true for that particular variable annuity?
I don't.
That's okay. Variable annuities are very confusing to people, and I used to think that was an accident, and I'm starting to think it's on purpose. So I would check first to see if you're going to give up any benefits that the annuity might have provided to you above and beyond just the normal investments. If you would give those up, you have to weigh out those benefits versus the cost of keeping the money in there. If there are no benefits you want to keep or there are no benefits, you can move that into an IRA wherever you want to go. You can go to a bank, a brokerage firm, an investment firm, a credit union, another insurance company, but I wouldn't recommend that. And you can have them establish an IRA for you. And you give them a statement, and they will have you sign a transfer document that will move the assets from the variable annuity into that new IRA. And there shouldn't be any taxes on it whatsoever because it's a custodian-to-custodian transfer. And therefore, there's no taxes on it because you never took possession of the money. And so look around for a financial advisor. Again, call the big discount players like Vanguard or Fidelity or Schwab, TD Ameritrade, Scottrade, what have you. See what they have to offer, but they'll handle all the paperwork for you, or at least they should. And once they get it from one place to another, then you have a lot more freedom and hopefully a lot lower expenses and more happiness over the account.
Mark, good luck. Thanks for the call. This is a good time to be in the financial housekeeping mood. We are closing in on the end of the year, a time when our finances could use a year-end checkup. Kevin McKinley is giving us the year-end financial to-do list. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment with more on your money on the Ideas Network.
Shop around.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's best to shop around, and On Your Money will help you do just that, making smarter decisions with your hard-earned greenbacks. Kevin McKinley is here to give insights. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. You can join in with your money question, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kevin, we've been talking about cutting the cost of watching TV, and this week you have some information on how to cut the proverbial cord. What should we do first?
Kate, let me ask you, if you don't mind, have you already cut the cord?
Have a cord? No, I don't even recall when we last had a cord. We did have a lot of fuzzy bunny ears in the past.
Well, then you are one of the cool kids, Kate, because according to the Pew Foundation in the United States, among all adults, 59% say that cable and dish are their primary source of television programming. 28% stream, and 9% say they just watch through an antenna. But of 18 to 29 year olds, only 31%. Use cable dish, 61% get their primary TV programming from streaming, and about 5% get it from an antenna. So good for you. You are ahead of the trend. And if you are a current subscriber to dish or cable and you're thinking about cutting the cord, you may want to use your sentiment to your advantage. Call your provider up and state your position and say, I'm thinking about cutting the cord. What can you do to induce me to stay with you and see what kind of packages they offer for you? Unless you get a better deal, you're leaving. And the worst they can do is say, see ya, and you'll just go on about your business and join Kate and these other advanced young Americans who are doing the same thing.
Well, assuming we follow through with the breakup, what's the next step?
The cheapest solution of all is the over-the-air antenna. It's about $20 to $30. The technology now is fantastic. You have one of these, I take it?
Mm-hmm. Yep, okay. Go ahead.
All right, you can go to tvfool.com or antennaweb.org and see what kind of channels you have in your specific area that are already available over the air. And I think you're going to be very surprised at the networks and local programming that you actually can get, even in HD, via the antenna. You can get your news programs, a lot of sports programming, drama and comedy series, etc. Now, the bad news about it is these are, of course, are going to be live only, and it's difficult to record them without a DVR. And you can have a DVR that does record over-the-air broadcast, but you're going to spend about $200 to $400. And there's nothing to stop you from going through the thrift shop and seeing if they have a working VHS recorder and ask your grandparents to program it for you.
So, what about streaming content over the web?
That is usually a much more affordable way to get TV on demand when you want it and when you want to watch. Now, you're going to either have to get it through one of two ways, through a data plan, which you can then watch on a phone or a tablet or attach it to your television through various devices. Keep in mind, if you have caps on your data, you're probably going to go over those limits. If you watch a lot of TV, like Netflix, for say. But that, for people who are just occasional watchers of TV, you might be surprised that you can actually get enough data via your cell service to actually watch several shows in a given month. Otherwise, you have to go to internet and Wi-Fi. You may have to go back to your cable provider to get the internet access. And depending on the speed, you're probably going to spend somewhere around $30 to $70 per month for that internet access that you can then use as Wi-Fi for streaming.
And then we're ready to stream all of this content we could want, right?
Yeah, you're going to need a streaming TV, something that's already equipped for it, that has some kind of software on it. What do you have, Kate?
I'm trying to think, what is the name of it? I haven't sat down, Kevin, to watch it. It's coming up blank. I'm not sure.
Okay, well, many people use a TV that already is streaming enabled, or they have a device like
Roku. Streaming enabled, yeah.
Streaming enabled, mm-hmm. All right. So you shell out a few extra bucks for a nicer TV.
Yes.
But you can also use a video game player, Amazon Fire Stick, the Google Chromecast. These are all about maybe $30 to $40 or so, and they do a good job of not only picking up the Wi-Fi signal and enabling the TV to stream your programming, but also to manage the programming. And some of them even allow you to record it as well. But otherwise, if you want to just watch it over a tablet or a phone, I mean, my kids watch movies mm-hmm. that are designed for huge screens on something that's, 2.5 inches by 4.5 inches, and they seem to be happy with it. I can't even get them off of it. So next time, in a couple weeks when we come back, we're going to talk about all the streaming services that are out there and how to save money on downloading content from the web.
Well, let's take another call now with Gary in Waukesha. Hi, Gary. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I'm calling about a little bit of extra money that I have and wondering what I should do with it in terms of paying off a mortgage, paying taxes in advance, and paying off interest possibly in advance, because I understand with the new tax plan that may not be a deduction in the future, or investing.
Yeah, Gary, are you working right now?
I am.
Okay. Does your boss know you're calling into a radio show while you're working?
I'm not at work this moment. No, I'm not.
Okay, good. I just wanted to make sure you weren't jeopardizing your source of income by calling with this question. Good. If you are working, are you maxing out all of your pre-tax contribution options to 401ks or 403bs?
I'm a public employee, and that goes into a separate fund. So I guess I'm maxed out, and yes.
Okay, if you're maxing everything out, then the next step is, do you have at least 3 to 6 months worth of living expenses set aside in a safer investment? Okay, good. Do you have anything that you have a planned expense, like a vehicle, a vacation, college expenses, whatever? Is that also, do you have money already designated for that purpose?
Yep, credit cards are taken care of, all of that's up to date.
Okay, good. Are you eligible to contribute to Roth IRAs?
I guess I don't know what the limit is.
Okay. Are you single or married?
Single.
Okay. You're probably in about $120,000 to $130,000 of gross income, and that should allow you to be eligible to contribute to a Roth IRA. And if you're below those amounts, I definitely recommend you also contribute to the Roth IRA, because you can invest that however you want, and you don't get a tax break on it, but you can pull the contributions, Gary, back out whenever you want with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. So it kind of works as an ERSAT savings account. And only after you've checked on whether or not you can make Roth IRA contributions would I actually look at paying down the mortgage for it. Especially since, again, this legislation looks like some form may come into place. But if there's one thing that we've learned over the last 12 months or so, just because legislation is proposed, it doesn't mean it's either going to go through or it's going to go through in the way that it was originally proposed. And even with this last batch here, there are a lot of billion-dollar interests who are very against several of the things, such as losing the mortgage deduction. The National Association of Home Builders, the Realtors Group, they're very against giving up any tax breaks for home buying, selling, and building. And they're very powerful lobbyists, and so it's likely that their voices will be heard, and that deduction may be kept on. Where they'll come up with the rest of the revenue they need to make the bill go through, of course, remains to be seen. But I wouldn't pay down the mortgage just for that particular purpose. And finally, it's a really cheap interest rate. And most people have mortgages that are in the 3 to 4% range. If you have money invested, you're not going to make that guaranteed every single year. But if it is in something that has slightly higher risk and reward, you're more likely to make that on average over the long period of time. So it's usually a better investment that way rather than to pay off the mortgage. But finally, if you've taken care of everything, you're financially independent, you don't have any other financial needs coming up, go ahead, pay off the mortgage. It'll probably feel good, and your monthly expenses will go down by the amount of the payment.
Gary, thanks for the call. Let's go to Bob now in Appleton, who joins us. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Kevin, got a question. I've heard your program quite often. You always say not to, when you get to 66, take your Social Security instead of waiting until 70. I'm 67. My wife did it at 66, and then I filed, and I think it's defer, where I'm collecting spousal benefits, so I'm waiting until I'm 70. But I thought because I'm in the higher tax bracket, I'm in a 35% tax bracket, that if I would collect my Social Security now, I would just be paying a good portion of it for taxes. So should I wait till I'm 70 or should I go and try to collect?
Yeah, Bob, the question on when to take Social Security usually boils down to one answer. You tell me how long you're going to live. I will tell you when you should take Social Security. If you're going to make it to 80 or more, it's usually better to wait, because you get usually an 8% higher check for every year that you wait. Meaning if you were to get $2,000 today, but you waited a year, the check a year from now is going to be $2,160. But now, of course, you've given up $24,000 worth of checks over this year. And so that $160 extra advantage takes a long time for that to get back up to offset the $24,000 you've foregone for it. I also don't like it when people have to draw down their savings to pay off their living expenses, and rather than taking Social Security, because I'd rather have you preserve your investments so that you can spend those for emergencies or fun things, rather than being basically broke and just waiting for a Social Security check. You don't sound like you're in any of those situations.
I'm not drawing down any savings. I've got a substantial income coming in probably for the next 10 years or so.
Okay, then you're probably, and then of course once you do reach 70, you probably have a significant amount of money in retirement accounts, right?
Correct.
Okay. Once you reach 70 and a half, Bob, of course, you have to start taking your required minimum distributions, which once you pile your Social Security on top of that, that still means the Social Security is going to be taxed at a very high rate. So you get to boil it down to, if you're going to make it to 80, great, wait. But otherwise, no, I'd take it as soon as you want it, because it sounds like it's going to be taxed at a high rate regardless. And keep in mind that Social Security right now is tax-free from the start, and then there's a formula that's used to determine if the Social Security is taxable. So, at the most, only 85% of your Social Security will be subject to taxation, and therefore the hit on it might not be as bad as what you think.
Bob, thanks so much for the call. Kelly emails, what's the best way to invest money for my children's college fund? We get money every year from family for Christmas and birthdays for our two small children, both under three, and we have put it in a regular savings account. Is there a better way to securely grow their accounts?
There are ways to grow the accounts, and there are ways to secure the accounts. There is no better way to securely grow their accounts. There's probably a better way to invest it, and that's the EdVest College Savings Plan for Wisconsin residents. You get a small tax break when you make contributions to the plan. Up to about $3,100 is reduced by your taxable income at the state level. So most people save about $100 if they put $3,000 or so into the EdVest plan each year for each kid. After that, the earnings are sheltered from taxation, and then when you pull it out for qualified higher education expenses, it's tax-free. And they do have an FDIC-insured option in that account, but it doesn't pay very much. It only pays about 0.5% to 1% or so. So you're not going to grow it, a lot with that option, but it is going to be secure. So you have a choice. What I would say is to maybe put half of that money into a savings account that you could use, and then invest the other half into EdVest so that you can pull that money out tax-free down the road. It may have some more growth to it, but it may have more risk. And then depending on what the future brings for you, one of those accounts will be good to tap once the kids are college age. And you can find out more information about that program at edvest.com, EDVEST.com. And we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And what's the website of the week?
GroundedReason.com is a great source for all things cord cutting and beyond. GroundedReason.com is, and we'll have that up at onyourmoney.com later on today.
And for more words before we go,
spend less, have more.
Kevin, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. On Your Money can be heard on the Ideas Network Tuesday mornings at 8 and rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. This hour was produced by Bill Martins with technical direction by executive producer Michelle Johnson. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.